Yes. Me dieron okay.
Awesome. The show must go on.
The show has to.
The show must go on.
Has to go.
Oh,
Joey's trying to be famous.
You do have to say okay, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had to switch to the phone because the tablet didn't work.
Hey, I got a. Heather. Hi, everybody, get your seats. And now it's time for Mike to read They Stopped in Time. Woo, we double mics tonight.
Mike Alcoholic. They stopped in time. Among today's incoming AA members, many have never reached the advanced stages of alcoholism, though given time, all might have. Most of these fortunate ones have had little or no acquaintance with delirium, with hospitals, asylums, and jails. Some were drinking heavily, and there have been occasional serious episodes. But with many, drinking had been a little more than a sometimes uncontrollable nuisance. Seldom had any of these lost either health, business, family, or friends. Why do men and women like these join AA? The 17 who now tell their experience answer that question. They saw that they had become actual or potential alcoholics, even though no serious harm had yet been done. They realized their repeated lack of drinking control, when they really wanted control, was the fatal symptom that spelled problem drinking. This, plus mounting emotional disturbances, convinced them that the compulsive alcoholism already had them, that complete ruin would be only a question of time. Seeing this danger, they came to AA. They realized that in the end, alcoholism could be as mortal as cancer. Certainly no sane man would wait for a malignant growth to become fatal before seeking help. Therefore, these 17 AAs and hundreds of thousands like them have been saved years of infinite suffering. They sum it up something like this. We didn't wait to hit the bottom because, thank God, we could see the bottom. Actually, the bottom came up and hit us. That sold us on Alcoholics Anonymous.
Okay, now it's time for our main speaker, Jason Cota de Casa.
My name is Jason Bittick. I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date is January 15th, 2013. I have a sponsor. His name is Todd Lyon. I have a home group. It's the Big Book Group up in Bellflower that Taylor talked about earlier. I want to thank Taylor for coming up with me. I want to thank my wife for driving up with me. And Trevor, the speaker getter, wherever you are, thank you for all your communication. I really do appreciate that. I got to tell you, I love that reading. I'd never heard that last reading, you know, because studying Alcoholics Anonymous the way I did back in the early days, they used to have a gatekeeper at the door. And if you hadn't hit a certain type of bottom, they wouldn't let you in. If you were younger than 45, they would not have let you in. Wouldn't have happened, you know? And then after about 10 years, they saw that there were so many of us that were exhibiting, you know, alcoholic behavior that still haven't lost the families or the jobs and everything else. And they opened the doors in order to, you know, to try to prevent some of you folks from experiencing the last 10 or 20 years of alcoholic torture that the rest of us had to endure. And I'll get into my story a little bit. You know, I mean, I just said that, you know, my sobriety dates, and you know, in 2013, my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was as a teenager in 1986. I'm no shooting star to long-term sobriety, you know, and there was a lot of things that I was doing to try to figure it out on my own. And we'll get into that in just a few minutes. But randomly, I grew up in I'm just going to jump right into it. I grew up in North Orange County. You know, similar to Taylor, I had, you know, relatively normal parents. You know, my dad did just well enough and my mom could stay home. You know, they were church going people. My dad was actually an Olympic athlete too. He was larger than life. You know, he was the type of guy in the neighborhood and at church that if anybody had any trouble, they always seemed to go to my dad, and my dad would figure out a way to help them one way or another. And I always wanted to be like my dad growing up. And there was, I can't put my finger on anything in the past and say that this is why I'm an alcoholic. And if you're new, you know, I want to welcome you at Alcoholics Anonymous. There were a bunch of newcomers that were in here. I don't remember my first 30 or 60 days other than, you know, coming in here, putting a hat down low and just looking down at my feet the whole time. I was so full of guilt and shame that I couldn't hear a damn thing that was coming from the microphone, but I knew, you know, that I was in the right place. And so growing up in Yorba Linda, you know, we had, it seemed like everybody on the street, like one season we would all be out playing soccer and all of our dads coached. And the next season we would roll over into Little League, you know, and our dads coached that too. And it was, you know, it was a blast. You know, I love playing sports, be running out and riding bikes and running dirt bikes in the areas of Orange County that hadn't been built up yet. And, you know, by the time I was in sixth grade, I had so much energy. My mom and dad actually thought it was a problem back then. They called it like ADD, right? And so they wanted to go and they put me on Ritalin in order to try to get me to focus on what they wanted me to focus on, right? But all that allowed me to do was really focus on the things that I wanted to focus on. You can't control somebody's focus. And even back in sixth grade, I was just deeply selfish and self-centered. I was going to do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. There were so many people that were sitting around me, you know, that I would see them studying and turning in homework, and there was already a disconnect because it seemed like everything that they were doing was natural. And for me, I didn't want to study. I couldn't connect why on earth this was even important. I was just going to hang out with my friends. I was looking forward to recess and lunch where we'd play tetherball and handball and everything else. And then when we get out of school, we're going to go out and play. And I just wanted to go, 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 go. You know, by the time we rolled into junior high school, I remember going on our very first family trip down to Carlsbad, and all the parents were out on a boat and there were a bunch of Marines playing football. And I decided I'm going to jump in and play football with these guys, you know, and afterwards, you know, they all went back to their room and I just followed them back there, and they were all drinking and they just didn't seem to care that I was there. And so I just kind of looked around. No one was paying attention to me. I went over to the bar and I made a little cup of Southern Comfort and this La Paz drink mix. And I went back and I just sat in the corner. And I started drinking this, and I'm telling you, I look back on that as being my very first, I guess, spiritual experience. You know, after I was done with about half of that drink, I just absolutely loved the effect that alcohol had on me. And I've always just absolutely just loved what it did for me, man. I loved to drink from the very first time that I drank, and I overshot the mark that very first time. And next thing you know, I'm throwing up and having to talk my way out of it, just, you know, with my parents just saying, I'm not feeling good. I'm going to go sleep, you know, sleep it off. And, you know, by the time junior high ended, my parents were sick and tired of all-star games and for soccer and baseball going into the end of summer because it was ruining family vacations, you know, for the family. And so they said, we just need you to maybe go play golf. And so they would just go drop me off at the golf course all day and I would just hit balls all day long. And I made the golf team as a freshman in high school and just loved it because there was a couple of seniors on the team and those guys would drive to matches and I'd sit in the back seat and they always had a couple of beers and wanted to smoke a joint. And I just felt like this is the greatest thing ever. I am absolute heaven. I mean, what could be better than drinking a couple of beers, smoking a joint and going to play golf? How do I sign up to do this for the rest of my life? Is there a way? Can I sign something now? No. But I never got good grades in high school. You know, it kind of carried over through elementary school that it was just, I was going to do as little as possible. You know, but by the time I was a sophomore, now I have a car because I'm 16 years old. And on the weekends, I'm going to go hang out with my friends that drink the way I drink. And, you know, every time I drink, I'm overshooting the mark, you know, and there's those nights that I remember falling asleep on or passing out on bathroom floors with my cheek on tile floors next to the toilet and just not really caring because, man, we just had an absolute blast. You know, by the time that I was a senior in high school, my golf game had really progressed. I was the LA Times High School Golfer of the Year, Orange County Register High School Golfer of the Year. I won Southern California Junior Championship, Southern California PGA Junior Championship. I qualified to play in a PGA Tour event as a senior in high school, and I was the youngest person in the Western United States to ever qualify and play in a PGA Tour event. And if you were to ask me what my life was going to look like right then, I'd have looked at you in the eye and said, you know what, I'm going to be on the PGA Tour someday. But first, I'm going to go to college. I'm going to be an All-American. I'm going to win a bunch of golf tournaments. I'm going to turn pro. Look, I don't want to spoil the ending. Right? I believed in the core of my soul that that's who I was. I was some just phenom golfer. But the reality is I was living a double life, because every second that I was not on the golf course, you know, I had a fake ID by the time I was 17. I was the guy that, you know, if anybody needed beer, I was the guy to go get the beer. And I just loved to drink. I didn't want to be told what to do. My parents, by this time, they're starting to see that maybe there's a problem. And every time they try to come tell me, you know, what's going on, you should do this, you should do that, you should do this. I tell my mom to stop shooting on me. If I want your opinion, I will come and ask. I know what I'm doing. That is, in my experience, that is what selfishness and self-centeredness looks like. Me not wanting any help from anybody. I've got this. Everything's under control. Well, I go off to college, right? And, you know, what I remember is going to class in the morning, and then right after class, I would play this game with another guy where we both would start off with a 12-pack, and we have to drink one beer every 5 minutes for an hour. So we have a 12-pack done in 1 hour. Then we're going to go out and do some drinking and go out into town. And I'm a bar drinker. I want to be around my people. They don't know they're my people, but when I walk in, I feel like, you know, I feel like they are, because I strike up conversations with just about anybody, because I am just so comfortable when I am drinking. And the problem is, the second week of school, I got thrown in jail on a Tuesday and a Thursday in the same week. And I was kicked out of college before the end of September. Yeah, pretty awesome. That's what my parents said. That's just great. Right. So what do my parents do? We live in Southern California. I bet you could guess. I just turned 19 years old, and they send me to a rehab. And so I'm sitting there and I'm talking to a therapist, and they're trying to help me get in touch with my inner child. They're trying to help me to examine my relationship with my parents, and talking about triggers and all those things that in my experience have absolutely nothing to do with long-term sobriety. And I would go to these young people's meetings all over Southern California, and be going to the Newport Club and the Canyon Club and hanging out wherever the cute girls were hanging out. No sponsor, no steps, no nothing. You know, I found that if I was carrying a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous around with me, that my parents left me alone. And that's the only reason I had it. I didn't understand what alcoholism was. I knew I didn't drink like other people, but I was proud of that. You know, hell, I mean, the day that I knew that I could drink a 12-pack and not throw up, I was pumped. It was like, oh, I have arrived, is what they call it. And it's like, oh my God, I can get a 12-pack and not even black out. It was pretty awesome. Anyways, I digress. So I was able to stay sober for about 10 months. But as a part of that, my parents then learned a few things. So by the time, you know, I started drinking again, they said, man, you can do whatever you want, son. You just can't do it here. And I didn't know where I was supposed to go at this point. So I decided what I was going to do is, you know, it had to be a problem of discipline. So I went and joined the United States Marine Corps. And I was fine in boot camp. And I was fine in Marine combat training. And I was fine in the School of Infantry. And I was meritoriously promoted out of all of that. I was a damn good Marine. But I get out and I go to my schooling, and next thing you know, I'm in Okinawa, Japan. And I go from being this class clown like I was in elementary school to now I'm just pissed off all the time. And all I want to do is drink and fight and look for women. And that's all I want to do. And I'm just angry all the time. And if you're new, more than likely, you know that anger that I'm talking about right now. I'm just pissed off. And and so I'm going out, I'm getting in fights at night, I'm making it back, and the people that and my sergeants where I'm working, they're looking at me and wondering what on earth I'm doing. What I try to do is I try to drink from 7 at night until 5 at morning when I go to work, and then I work from 5 in the morning till about 1 in the afternoon, and then I try to sleep for 4 or 5 hours before going out, and it's happening over and over and over. And one day I rolled into work at 5 in the morning, and I let my staff sergeant know that I don't want to work today. Now, you can pull that shit off at Denny's. Yeah, you don't do that in the United States Marine Corps. And, you know, and I end up losing all of my rank. I end up being put on barracks restrictions. But the thing is, I didn't care. It's like, what are you doing? You're going to take $40 a month away from me because I lose my rank? I don't care. I'm going to drink and I'm going to sneak out and I'm going to do what I want to do when I want to do it because I don't want to be here. This is not my career path. You can't hurt me. There's nothing to a man that has lost all hope is a very dangerous man. And they finally came to me. And one day the commanding officer in my base looks at me and he says, Private, do you think you might have a drinking problem? And I don't know what you hear, when you hear that question, but what I hear is they already know, and I better just, oh yeah, I definitely do. And I said, yes, I have a drinking problem. Now I'm 21 and I'm in Japan and I'm going through a rehab and I'm sitting with all these therapists. And what do they want to talk about? They want to examine my relationship with my parents and help me get in touch with my inner child and talk about triggers and all that crap that has absolutely nothing to do with recovery from alcoholism. And I'm in there for 90 days. And when I get out after 90 days, physically, I am strong. They've given me food. They've nursed me physically back to health. They haven't touched the spiritual malady or the spiritual illness that I deal with. But physically, I get out of there and everything is going to be okay this time. It's going to be different. And I go back to the Marine Corps barracks, and it took about a week before I was drinking again. And I got into a couple of fights. And then the day came where the Marine Corps let me know that, Jason, we don't have any room for you here anymore. You need to get out of here. And they sent me back to Yorba Linda. And now I'm in Yorba Linda, 22 years old. And as I mentioned, my parents know what's up. They said, I tell you what, son, you can stay here, but you've got to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's like, okay, this time I'm going to do it. When I jumped in, and I used to walk to a meeting that was about a mile down the road from my parents' house. And I got a sponsor, and I started to take some steps. And, if you're new, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news for you. The good news is you jump in here and get a sponsor, you're going to get some of your stuff back. You're going to get a car, you're going to have a place to live, maybe even be dating somebody. That's the good news. The bad news is none of those things are the solution to your problem today. And after, months of sobriety, I met a beautiful woman and I ended up getting married to this woman. And I started a little insurance agency, and we bought a house, and it actually did have a little white picket fence around it. I mean, people say that, oh my God, it actually did have a little. I didn't put it in; it was in there already. Then we had my son Palmer, and then we had my daughter Peyton, and on paper, you would look at my life and say, my God, this is that you have a really good life. I even started volunteering, coaching the local high school golf team, helping out the golf coach there. It was great. But as I look back on it, with every single one of those life events, it was one less meeting, one less meeting, one less meeting, one less meeting, until all I'm doing is I'm going to church on Sundays. And I'm convincing myself that going to church on Sunday is going to provide me all the spirituality I need to stay sober. Now, I'm not here to give you my opinion about religion. But what my experience was is I was treating church like a history lesson. I would go and I would learn the different books and the different people and the different teachings and everything. It was a history lesson. It wasn't a relationship building activity, which in my experience the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are. And the big book tells us that if an alcoholic of my type fails to perfect and enlarge his conscious contact with God through hard work and self-sacrifice, he's not going to survive. There's certain low spots ahead. And when I was 8 years sober, my father passed away and he was my hero, And I didn't really know what I was supposed to do. For some reason, I didn't go back into AA. I just thought I just need to work harder. I just need to be a better man, And with my son and my daughter, I'm having to take them to school every morning. And I'm having to pick them up after school every day because my wife, she's an elementary school principal and she has to work long hours. She's up before I am and she goes to bed after I'm already in bed. But all I can think is I didn't sign up for this. I didn't sign up to be, to do everything with this family so she can go and do that. And then she would come to me on weekends and say, it's family time. It's like, screw that. I had family time all week. Where were you? I was so deeply selfish and self-centered. All I could think about was me and what I was getting when that woman didn't change one bit from the day that I met her to the day that I end up walking out on her and those kids. And I'm telling you, the day came and I was convinced that, you know what, the reason that I feel the way that I'm feeling is because she does not love me the way I deserve to be loved. And boy, it sure wouldn't be fair to have my son and my daughter grow up in a household that, you know, in a loveless marriage or whatever the crap was that I tried to convince myself that made it okay for me to walk out on them, you know, and I walked out on them. And within, you know, it probably took about a month when I realized that wasn't the problem. I started drinking again. I was 13 years sober and I started drinking again. And I immediately started drinking just like I did when I was in the Marine Corps. And it did not take long before I lost my business. My car got repossessed. The house that they were in, it went into foreclosure. And she even came to me and said, look, at my family's back in Florida. Will you let me go back with the kids? I need help. And for a year, I didn't even let them because, you know, I have rights as a dad, right? Even though I'm not showing up, all I'm doing is sitting around drinking. And it was probably about a year later that I went to her and said, okay, you know, you can take them back to Florida. And she did that. And I was trying to drink myself to death here in California. You know, I had lost my business. Everything was pretty much lost. And, you know, the thought came to me that I know somewhere deep down inside of me, I'm a good dad because he was there before. I don't know where that dad is, but I know somewhere in there, there's that dad. I tell you, maybe what I'll do is I'll go back to Florida and I'll get a place somewhere close to where my kids are, where I can pick them up and see them, or I can see them after school and all that stuff. And I can participate in their lives. You know, things will be different this time. I'll just stop drinking or try to slow it down a little bit. And so I ended up getting a job with a great company in Orlando. And I went back there and I got an apartment that wasn't any more than about 3 or 4 miles from where my kids lived. And my purpose for being there was to go and be a dad. That's why I was going to be there. And if you would have asked me once I got there what my week was going to look like, I would have looked at you in the eye and I'd have said, I'm going to show up on Tuesday and I'm going to pick up my daughter Peyton after school and I'm going to take her to dance. On Thursdays, I'm going to pick up my son and I'm going to take him to Little League. On Fridays, I'm picking them both up after school. And we're going to sit in our pajamas all weekend watching cartoons. I'm going to make them pancakes 3 meals a day. I don't care. We're going to have a blast. It's going to be awesome. I'm going to bring them back on Sunday night to their mom. That's what my week is going to look like. Tuesday would roll around. As soon as work is done, I go straight to the bar because I got about an hour before I got to get my daughter. You know, and I can't drink beer anymore because the carbonation had destroyed my stomach. And the doctor said that I can't be doing that. So I switched to vodka, obviously. And, right? I'm only in AA would you laugh at that. And when I go to the bar, what I do is I order a vodka cran and it goes into a bucket and it's 3 shots of vodka and it's a half a shot of cranberry sauce. If it's too red, I'm going to give it back to you. You know, you don't want to be my bartender. Don't give me too much cranberry sauce. You need me diabetes or something. Smart ass drunk. But I would drink one of those every 20 minutes, just around the clock, normally from 5 o'clock when I got there until 2 o'clock in the morning when I left. But, you know, the point with that is that just before I'm supposed to go pick up my daughter, next thing you know, I'm texting my ex-wife saying, look, my boss needs me to work late. You know, and I would continue drinking. And Thursday would come around with every plan to go and hang out with my son Palmer and maybe even help coach him. And the thought finally comes that, you know what, if I can't see my daughter on Tuesday, it sure wouldn't be fair to see my son on Thursday. And I'd come up with another excuse. And the weekend would come and the exact same thing would happen. I look back on that and I was seeing them maybe once every 3 weeks when that was my purpose. All I wanted to do was to go and be a dad, but alcohol was making every decision in my life. Alcohol and fear made every decision in my entire life. I just thought my life was over. You know, there were 3 different bars that I drank at on the same street. One day I forgot where I parked. And this was at the beginning of social media. And I still remember posting this. Hey, anybody see my car? And it didn't get the response that I thought it was going to get. All of a sudden, people thought that was some big red flag. I didn't really care what they were thinking. But, you know, the next day it was like day 2. Anybody seen my car? I don't know where my car is. But I would go to the bar and think that, okay, well, if I had enough drinks, it'll clear my mind enough, and then I'll remember where it was, and I'll go and get it. And then it'll all make sense. But I go and I have a few drinks, and then it's, who cares what a car is? What do I need the car for? And then 4 days later, they found it. A friend of mine found it right across the street from the bar at CVS underneath this sign that says 20-minute parking or you're going to get towed. Well, 4 days later, it wasn't towed. But I remembered it was like, oh, I rolled in there to get cigarettes, and then I just walked to the bar. But there were three bars that I went to. I would start at one of them and drink for a couple hours and think that maybe everybody is over at that second bar. And so I would drive over there, and I'd be at that bar for a while. And then, oh, I think everybody's over at Rocco's Tacos. And I would drive over there and drink. After I left that third bar to go home at 2 o'clock in the morning, there was a McDonald's right by the freeway off ramp. And oftentimes I would drink myself to a place where you're kind of seeing double. And I found a solution that worked for me is I would get two cheeseburgers. And I'd be eating with one, and I'd have to put one on my eye while I was driving. And so if you looked over at me and I looked at you and I had a cheeseburger on my eye, it might look kind of funny. It was only one exit, but so I covered up this eye and I'd take a bite out of this one. Man, I never forget that. It's some really good stuff. And I think you could tell that just by nature when I'm drinking, I'm very defiant. And when I was drinking, most days when I was ready to leave the bar and go home, if my drink was only halfway done, I would just walk out with my drink. I wouldn't look around. By the time I moved out of this place, out of that place, when I got out of the psych ward, which I get into in a minute, and I had to clean it out, I probably had 75 or 80 of these glasses in my apartment, plus about 30 appetizer dishes, which you do other things with. But and I would just walk right out, or I would walk out with that drink, and I would drive over to the other bar, and I would just walk in with it. And this was 15 years ago. I had a pretty big beard. I was very angry. I just don't think anybody wanted to say anything to me. I wouldn't have wanted to say anything to me. And I knew that alcohol at this point, I knew I couldn't kill myself. And I thought, what if I just go back to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I don't even know where that thought came. It hadn't been into my mind for a long time. And so I rolled into this meeting that was in this mobile home. I just looked it up, and there was like three people in there. And I got drunk before, and I went to the meeting, and I drank after. The next day I rolled in, I got drunk before, I went to the meeting, and I left. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says multiple times in the doctor's opinion that for many of us, a definite hospital stay is in order. And I was very fortunate enough to be able to be given an opportunity to go into a rehab. And so I checked myself into this rehab. And on day two of the rehab, I went up to the nurse's station. I said, hey, I checked myself in here, right? And the nurse said, yes. I said, well, I need to check myself out right now. And she said, well, I think that would be against doctor's orders. Like, I don't give a shit about your doctor's orders. I need out right now. And I might have said it aggressively. And she just said, okay, let me just go get the paperwork and you can leave. And I remember signing something. And I remember walking out to my car and feeling these rocks under my feet. And they talk about the four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I knew it was over. I had just tried AA. I had just tried rehab. There isn't anything left for me. My mind's telling me that my best days are behind me. My kids don't want to talk to me. I don't have any friends. Maybe the bartenders, I'd like to convince myself that the bartenders are my friends. But, they're being paid to be there. I want to be free. And I don't even care what that means. And the day came where I found this 5-story parking structure that didn't have a fence around the top of it. And it was like, oh, my God, this is how I can finally end this thing. I'd never had a plan before. I just didn't want to live, And the day came, and in the process of going and doing that, I was detained, and I was put into a behavioral health facility not of my choosing. Back there, they call it Baker Acted. Here, they call it 5150. And thank God, because I couldn't get out. 4 or 5 days in there, and I remember the guy came in with some, blood all over his neck and gauze. And I remember asking this guy, what on earth did you do? And he made some comment about like trying to swallow a razor blade when he was drunk or something crazy. And And I sat back and I remember just saying under my breath, you know, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And there was a guy in the back of the room who hadn't said a word forever who said, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Here's the problem. I'm in the psych ward and I can recite a portion of chapter 3. I can recite a portion of chapter 5. I can tell you about the steps and the traditions. I can jump on into Bill's story and have a conversation with you. I can talk to you about Dr. Silkworth and the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, but I don't have one day of sobriety. If you're in here to learn something, good luck. You know, I learned a bunch and it led me right into the psych ward. Like I said, 1986 was my first attempt at getting sober. And now here we are in January of 2013. I am a head full of AA and a body full of booze. And I got out after 5.5 days. Thank God everything was clear. And I rolled into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a little bit bigger meeting. And this man walked up to me and he said, son, if there's a body laying on the side of the road, when do you think the paramedics should start working on him? And I said, well, right then. Thought it was a good answer. He said, you're right, right then. He said, son, you have been in a terrible accident. We don't get together right now and start to do some step work. You're going to die. And you know what? No greater truth had ever been spoken to me in my life. And what came out of my mouth next is what I've learned is what a surrender is. And that's just tell me what to do. I don't care what it is. And if you're wondering what a sponsor is, it's just somebody who's gone through this path that's willing to show you what they did. Whether or not you do it, that's your business. You know, but as a sponsor, all I ever do is just show somebody what I've done. And that day he got me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and he asked me to read the doctor's opinion and come back the next day. As I say this and it comes out of my mouth right now, it seems easy. At the time, it was not easy. It seemed almost insurmountable to read one chapter and to show up the next day when I had nothing else going on. And I showed up the next day. And he got me and he told me to read Bill's story and come back the next day. At about 19 days of sobriety, I was able to make my way back out here to California because I knew a bunch of you were out here. And I got out here on about day 20 and I got a sponsor that I had before and we sat down and we read the doctor's opinion. And it talked about how Bill had requested the privilege of going back into the hospital to share his experience with other alcoholics. You know, and the light bulb came on. It's like, I've never done that. It's 26 years later, I've never done that. So starting on that day, what I started doing was I would go to a meeting with my sponsor in the morning. In the afternoon, I would go up to this detox in Costa Mesa. And at night, I would go to another meeting. I didn't want to go to that detox. I was not comfortable going to that detox. I didn't know what I was supposed to say. It started off with, I had four things that I would say, and this seemed brutal. You know, what's your name? Where are you from? How many days sober are you? I'm glad you're here. That took everything just to do that. Days later, as I'm going through the book with my sponsor, I was reminded that I needed to carry a message of depth and weight. Means I can't just be nice to people. That doesn't get people sober. And what it meant was as I had to take some steps. If I really wanted to help somebody, I needed to get through the 12 steps. I felt like I had lost everything in my life. There was no reason for me to go through the 12 steps other than maybe it would help somebody else. And so I jumped in and I did it about as fast as I possibly could. I had enough money for about 2 months in sober living in Costa Mesa. And about month three, I ran out of money completely. The big book tells me that I need to work out my solution on the spiritual and the material will follow. That means if I haven't gone through the 12 steps, a job doesn't mean a whole lot. And I started to sleep in a warehouse in Costa Mesa that had a couch. And I started to, and I kept going to Charlie Street to try to learn how to talk to these guys. And it's funny, this location where we are right now, the day came when I was about 3.5 months sober that I went to a Friday morning meeting down here at this pizza place. And there was this 18-year-old kid that shared that day, that morning. It was like 7 a.m. He shared about how much he hated his life and how disappointed in himself that he was and how much he hated his family. And I'm listening to this kid share and I'm thinking, that kid's going to drink today. Yeah, that kid's going to drink today. And I went up to him after the meeting. I said, what are you doing today, son? He said, I don't know. I said, well, you're going to spend the day with me. I was twice his size. He was going to spend the day with me whether he wanted to or not. I wasn't totally sure how to carry the message, but I'd have carried his ass to my car if I had to. That kid wasn't going to drink. That kid was not going to drink. Thank God he came willingly. But what we did was we went to Denny's, you know, and I shared about being 19 years old in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, rolling in there with a hat on backwards, more worried about my image than my soul and how it damn near killed me. We talked all morning. And then that afternoon we went to the meeting at a Canyon Club and he shared again. He still wasn't in a good spot, but it didn't matter because we were together. We talked all afternoon. And then that Friday night came and we looked up a meeting down here in Laguna Niguel and we found just a participation meeting and we rolled in and it was only like seven people. You know, you roll in and it's like, oh, well, everyone's going to have to share. You can't hide, right? So, but by the time it got around to this kid, he had a smile on his face. He was laughing. He talked about how much he loved his life, how much he couldn't wait to see his family again. His entire deportment had completely changed. And I'm looking at this kid and I'm blown away by what I'm listening to. Couldn't believe it. When I dropped that kid off that night, I felt something inside of me that no drink, no drug, no money, no relationship, no house, no nothing had ever given me. And all I had to do was try to help another man stay sober that could not do a damn thing for me all day long. And I knew that you were right. I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous was right. This whole time you were right. All I've got to do is go out and try to help you guys stay sober and God will take care of me. He absolutely will take care of me. I couldn't believe it. And from that point, I started looking at meetings different. I started coming in and as weird as it sounds, I started hunting. I started because I know what it looks like to be in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous and be in pain, you know, be sitting there wondering why you still have to go through this crap full of shame and full of guilt. I know what that looks like because I felt it, you know, and I'd go try to sponsor as many of these guys as I could. And I absolutely loved it. They ended up kicking me out of the warehouse. And for the next 30 days, I slept in my car at the Canyon Club, right? When you pull in, quick left, you know, the traffic, you can fall asleep if you have to. No one ever died from lack of sleep. But from that point, I ended up getting a job and took about 3 weeks before I could just rent a room. And I would go to a meeting every morning. I'd go to work and I'd go to a meeting at night, you know, and I remember it was about a year sober. My daughter calls me and says, Dad, we have this father-daughter dance going on here in Orlando. You know, will you fly out and dance? And it's like, I remember sharing with my sponsor that I was so grateful to even get a phone call like that, you know. But the challenge is for somebody that had been sleeping in his car in his warehouse, there's no money. So planes, trains, automobiles, hotels and crap like that, you know, and I thanked her from the bottom of my heart. And, you know, within about 2 or 3 days of, you know, a bunch of guys from down here in one of my groups, you know, they all put their miles together and allowed me to fly back. Yeah. Man, thank God it's humid in Orlando, and I was sweating because, man, I didn't realize I was a crier till I got sober, you know. And I was crying. I just couldn't believe it. You know, I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. I met my wife in my home group, and we just had our three-year anniversary. We've been together for about 9 years, and we've got a sober home, and we have alcoholics in there all the time doing step work or feeding them or just hanging out with them. My son today, he's 23 years old and he calls me 2 or 3 times a day. I wouldn't call my dad when I was 23. You know, he calls me 2 or 3 times a day. And you guys taught me how to communicate with my own kids. You know, my ex-wife reached out to me and told me that my daughter was having a really tough time, you know, in school and with her grades and would I help? And I just, my heart swelled. I couldn't believe that she was asking me to go and help my daughter. You know, I'm like, okay, what am I going to say? I thought about it for a couple of days. And then the thought came that this is a trap. She's an elementary school principal. She doesn't know what to say to her. She wants her dad who was sleeping in a warehouse to, okay, hold on. What's the big book tell me to do? Okay. We got to pause. What do we got to do? Okay. A couple of days later, I called my daughter. I said, Peyton, I remember being in elementary school. I remember looking around at everybody and all of them seemed to know what they were supposed to be doing. I just felt like I was on the outside looking in. I was so uncomfortable all the time. And I can still feel like that today. And today, if I just try to look at today, I can get through just about anything today. And that's all I shared with her, just my experience. I didn't tell her what to do. I didn't yell at her. I didn't scold her. I did what you taught me to do in AA. A week later, she calls and says, "Dad, can I get your email address?" It's like, what the hell do you mean? Why do you want my email address? Well, she says, "Well, if I get in trouble, I want to give it to the school because you understand me." It's like, shit, I don't understand you. I don't understand what's going on right now. What the hell is this? And I have taken the same lessons and have done the exact thing with my son. As I don't tell him what to do. If there's an opportunity to share my experience, I'll share my experience. If not, I'll say, "Son, I don't have any experience with this. You probably should go talk to somebody else about it." You know, maybe the greatest gift or the greatest experience that I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous is that that hole in my stomach, that hole in my gut goes away if all I do is just love you. If I love the people in my home group, if I love my friends, if I love the people that I work with, if I love a room of complete strangers, I don't have that feeling anymore. I don't need anything. It sounds weird, but I don't need my wife to love me to feel complete. I already feel complete. You know, the fact that she loves me is icing on the cake for sure. I'm very grateful. Thanks. But I don't need anything. So if you're new, and this is your very first attempt at getting sober here in Alcoholics Anonymous, or if you're new and you were like me and have come in and out a few times and you're new again, there isn't anybody, not your sponsor, not your friend, not the person you're sitting next to. Nobody can look at you with any degree of certainty and tell you what your life is going to look like months from now, or even years from now for that matter. But I promise you this, you get a sponsor and take all 12 of these steps, your life will be different than it is right now. And if you are an alcoholic of my type, anything different is an absolute miracle. You have taken a garden variety drunk like me. And just like the book says, you have made me happily and usefully whole again. And for that, I'm grateful.
Thanks, Jason. Love is the only thing that is real in life. Okay. Thanks, Jason. Thanks again for being our speaker.